So throughout 2023, been far too many stories in Alberta on violent crime. We've had shootings, we've had police officers murdered in Edmonton, random attacks, stabbings, daylight killings, you name it. One in Edmonton recently grabbed a lot of headlines, an 11-year-old kid apparently deliberately shot and killed. Like I say, those are the headline grabbers, but there have been lots of coverage of what we've called a general state of social disorder or civil disorder, especially in the big cities in Alberta. So what's going on? And what can we expect in 2024? Dan Jones is the chair of justice studies at Northwest College, but not just another academic. Dan spent years and years on the job with the Edmonton Police Service, so he knows this from both sides. Dan, thanks for coming in. Merry Christmas. Good to see you.
Merry Christmas.
Okay, so as someone who's really, I mean, you grew up in the job, right? Your dad was a cop. This has been your life. Give us your assessment. How bad do you think it is? Because we see the stories, and I think people are concerned. How bad is crime in Alberta right now?
It's getting up there, but it's a cyclical thing, and I think that's one of the things that we forget. We think that this is, oh my goodness, it's so bad. There were times I can think of a time in 2005 where we had 14 shootings in 2 weeks.
Okay.
Right? So crime is cyclical. So it's depending on what's going on in that criminal world, whether there's unrest around drug trade or unrest around turf wars or whatever. So that's one of those things that we have to pay attention to. And I think sometimes we make a mistake. We go a year-by-year comparison. We're like, oh, compared to last year.
Yeah.
We need to go compared to over the last 5 or 10 years and go, what's it look like? And I think what you'd see then, if you really followed the data properly, you'd see that it's not as bad as what it seems to be, if that makes any sense.
It does. It makes perfect sense, because I think, you know, especially somebody who's been in this business for a long time, those big stories come along. Like I say, the two police officers killed in Edmonton, the 11-year-old boy shot on the south side a month ago. You've got incidents in Calgary in shopping centers and things like that. So when people see that, it's kind of like that changes it for people, right? Maybe it gives us a false perception of how bad it is, but it certainly does affect what the public are feeling and thinking.
For sure, and it's and when you hear like the shooting at Kingsway Mall, where some gets shot and he loses a part of his hand, and that kind of stuff is terrifying for sure. But it's also, we're not Baltimore. Baltimore is a city of 600,000 in the United States that has roughly 350 murders a year.
Right.
We are a city of 1.4 million, and we have, you know, 30 to 40 murders a year. So we're still relatively safe where we are when you look at that stuff. But it's also some of the random violence, like on the LRT, you're seeing a random violence
for
on
sure.
The LRT, and people are talking about that. I have colleagues that take the LRT every day and don't feel unsafe, and I sat and chatted with them. So the stories are what the stories are. And yes, you're seeing some of the drug use, and you're seeing random violence, but still at the same time, there's a lot of people that use those services and don't feel unsafe.
And don't have any incidents.
No, and have zero incidents.
They're
and they
completely
take it every
fine.
Day.
As someone who's lived in this city all my life and lived in this province, I notice a difference. And I'm not saying it's necessarily criminal, but you do see, like, I go walking in the River Valley down in Gold Bar, and you see tents and you see encampments. So there's definitely been a change. How much of a perception does that create? Because people see it. I mean, you go downtown Edmonton or Calgary, you see it. It's in your face, Dan. You can't get away from it. It scares people.
100%. And that's where I'm the same as you. I grew up in the city, and we didn't see that before. And I walked a beat on 118th Avenue from 2000 to 2005. And I didn't see that there. Right? We had the odd individual who was unhoused, but we didn't have encampments like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that speaks to a greater issue, and I think that speaks to how we're servicing those individuals. Like, how our shelter systems are, some of the unhoused people don't want to go to them because they feel unsafe.
Yeah.
And also there was an article done in The Walrus by Sarah Schulman talking about sleep and shelters. You don't actually sleep in a shelter because it's never dark. You're 4 feet away from someone else who's possibly tweaking out because
you're on guard.
Dope, you're on guard. So you're not sleeping, and sleep is really important. Like, anyone who hasn't slept for a long time, it sucks, right? So it's. I think we have to change the way we do things like that, and I think you'd see a difference in that unhoused population. And the other part of that unhoused population, when I was still with the police service, we looked at who was committing the most crime, and I think we narrowed it down to roughly 9 people committing 50% of the harm within the unhoused population.
Is that right? 9 people?
Yeah. It's that concept of the power few, and what you need to do is focus on those power few individuals who are causing the most harm, because the vast majority of unhoused people are not,
of course,
criminals. They're individuals who don't have a place to live, and unfortunately sometimes have mental health and drug issues.
Okay, I want to ask you about a couple of things in that area because I think it's important. And those social issues, and that's tough, but that's the old saying, you can't police your way out of this. That's true, 100%. Right? You can't. We're going to have to come up with a strategy to make sure that we deal with this on a more granular, like where it starts, what are the causes? How do you even do that? Where do you start with that,
Dan? You know what I would suggest, and I'm unfortunate, we did research myself and along with the University of Alberta Prison Project, research on the victim-offender overlap in incarcerated individuals. So we've interviewed over 800 people incarcerated in Western Canadian, both federal and provincial prisons. And we found that 97% of women and 95% of men have violent or sexual violent histories where they've been traumatized, with the vast majority of that violence occurring prior to them ever committing a crime as in childhood. And I think what we need to do, if I had a magic wand, I would take money out of whatever pot the province has, that $20 billion that they gave to the oil field or whatever billion dollars they have in surplus, and make it so people can go get help, so people can go get cognitive behavior therapy, EMDR, or whatever therapy they need.
Yeah.
Because in our research, we actually had several individuals that needed therapy, lots of that wanted it, but we had one specific one that stands out to me where she had no criminal background, and she went and robbed a bank. And waited for the police and then turned herself in and then got a federal prison sentence because she heard she could get cognitive behavior therapy.
What?
In the prison cell. And she'd been on a list for 3 years to try to get it outside of jail. And she had a very, very unfortunate sexual violent history in foster homes. And we have people doing that. We've had other people saying, I'm so glad to be in jail. I don't have to use crystal meth, specifically our female sample, because they were using drugs to stay awake. Not because they were, you know, these addicts that needed the drugs, that they were afraid they were going to get raped on the street.
Right.
So there's just unsafe spaces, and we're not addressing the trauma that creates basically the vast majority of our crime. And if you look at the social determinants of health and crime, they're almost identical. One we deal with a public health lens, and the other one we deal with the justice lens, and it's not effective.
Exactly. And so many people, as we know, fall through the cracks. I want to ask you about what we have seen in terms of responses from the city and in terms of responses from the province, and that is adding more enforcement. And while I agree, you can't police your way out of this, at the same time, Dan, don't we have to say, yeah, but we do need to have a presence for the interest of public safety?
100%. And the perception of safety is also there too, right?
Of course.
I would suggest that there are evidence-based ways of doing things that are not being done right now. So there's a concept called hotspots policing. Hotspots policing is not flooding an area with police officers. It's going into these kind of micro spaces, so like a couple block radius, and you take two police officers and you put them in there and they kind of walk around and they say hi to people. No action imperative, not trying to get warrants, not trying to get into people's pockets, not trying to arrest people. It's really just being present.
Just being visible.
15 minutes a time and randomized throughout the day. So 15-minute intervals randomized throughout the day. It's called the Koper curve. And the research on it is extensive and it's effective. 30 to 80% reductions in crime on every experiment that's been done across the world.
Wow. And 15 minutes, couple times a day.
Yeah.
Just be there.
Just be there. And the reason the 15 minutes works is if you're there all the time, you just become part of the street furniture and they'll commit crime around you. The 15 minutes, it sits in their brain like, oh, there's cops everywhere.
Sure,
it almost
feels
like there's cops everywhere more when they're not there all the time. They're just there for every 15 minutes. Because the concept of blitz policing, where you flood an area with people, that actually, all the research on that actually shows that it increases crime. Because as soon as the police leave, then everyone's like, we got 5 minutes to get, we got to eat. And all of a sudden, boom, crime happens. So it's about really following those evidence-based practices and using your resources with that will actually be way more efficient.
Does that fit to that whole community policing model that we hear so much about? Because isn't that sort of more of the blitz, or are they trying to incorporate both of those?
What you're seeing right now, I think you're seeing a lot of more of the blitz is what you're seeing.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, but that's what you're seeing. And it's because it's really hard. That's where that line between academics and policing gets blurred. It's hard because it's like, well, you can't don't tell us what to do. You're an academic. And it's like Larry Sherman from the University of Cambridge, where I went and got my master's degree. He's big on evidence-based policing. He has a conference every year, but he always talks about how it's that link in between, because people don't like to be told what to do, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's like, I know what to do because I've done it for so long. Although if we're going to keep doing the same thing over and over again, and we have the same result, and we know what that's
well, exactly. But you make a good point, and I think there are certain industries, and I'm way pro police, and I say that every time we talk about this. But I think there is sort of there probably is a mindset where, hey, listen, you haven't been out here, you haven't seen what we're doing. You have, right? So you're seeing this from both sides of the line. But I'm sure I would have the same thing if somebody came in here who had studied media all their life and never actually gone and stuck a mic in somebody's face. I'd be like, you don't know what you're talking about. So I can see where that comes in, but the study's there, the data's there, so it is important.
It is, and it's really that it's that getting to the next level of policing. Like, I'm a pro police person too. Sometimes I know people think I sound like I'm negative about the police, and I don't ever mean
to. Which is crazy.
I tend to come across that way, but I'm a police reformer too. Like, I'm a believer that we need to change the way we do policing. Like, we've had this conversation since I remember this conversation starting in 1991 with Rodney King.
Okay, yeah.
To change the way policing is done, it's marginally changed.
Yeah.
We had the same conversations after the murder of George Floyd that we did after the beating of Rodney King.
True.
And it's about, where do the police need to change? And one of the things I think the police need to do, and I think this is really important, is asking the community what they need from us rather than telling the community what they need from us. And we have a history of just going in and doing things because we think we know what's right for the community. And I use the worst example in Canadian history of when the government thought they were doing the right thing was residential schools.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still kind of doing that sometimes. We're still going in and telling people,
this is what you need.
This is what you need. We know best. We know what you need best. There was a police chief in, he's in Raleigh, North Carolina. Harry Dolan was his name, and he was the guy who went out and said to the community, let's figure out what you want. And he did like these dotmocracy things where he'd give everyone 10 dots. He'd get tables of 8 people. They'd write all their policing priorities. They put them up on the wall, and he'd have the entire community go and place their dots on what they thought the priorities were.
Okay.
And they were not even close to what the police thought the priorities were.
Is that right, hey?
Yeah. And they ended up out of that building a couple of youth centers for youth to, and he ended up reducing crime because he went and asked the community what they needed, and what they needed was was stuff for their youth, and crime went down.
And that's what you're talking about, the evidence-based. We can see it. This is what worked. Dan, we need to take a quick break. We're chatting with Dan Jones, who is the chair of justice studies at Northwest College and a former officer for the Edmonton Police Service. We'll be back with more right after this. We're chatting with Dan Jones, who is the chair of justice studies at Northwest College. How long were you on the force, Dan?
25 years.
You did the full 25, yeah. Hey? Yeah. So he was with EPS for a long, long time. So he's got a unique perspective in terms of he's done all the book learning, but he also spent a lot of time on the streets, and so he knows this inside out and backwards. And one thing that we've heard so much about, Dan, and you mentioned that 9 representatives of our houseless population sort of drove the majority of crime. We hear so much about bail reform, the revolving door. You're arresting the same guy day after day. How big of an issue is that right now?
So I think bail reform is something that has been talked about multiple times over my career, and I don't think bail reform is the answer.
Okay.
You know, we had a remand center that housed roughly 450 people, and we built one that houses roughly 1,750 people, and we
still
have 1,750 people in there, right? It's about reintegration. It's about what do you do when they're on bail? You know, and this is the one of those things the police get blamed for, but this isn't the police's job, right? And someone gets released on bail, and they have conditions, and they have all these things, and you know, recently in that Kingsway Mall shooting, that person was on bail.
Yep.
There is no resources for these folks. There is no counseling. There is no addictions treatment. There is nothing. Here's a piece of paper that says you're not supposed to use drugs or alcohol. Well, if that was that easy, I guess a lot of people
would
recover from addictions a lot quicker.
We wouldn't have the problem.
A piece of paper, right? So I think bail reform becomes the easy thing. I think we have to look at the whole justice system. We have to go, okay, let's put some resources into these folks. And the problem is we still have a punishment mentality. So I was like, why would we put resources into them? They made these decisions. Well, did they? I'm not saying you take away their responsibility, but when you look at the concept or an impact of trauma on someone's growth and brain power, and if they've been traumatic their whole life and they've had all these traumas going on, they're going to make different decisions based on the trauma, and we need to address those things. And I think that's where we need to start putting the investments into, is when someone is on bail, let's make sure that they have the ability to get counseling, to make sure they have the ability to get different resources. Because what we do right now is you're so dangerous on Saturday that we can't let you out of jail, and then 2 weeks later we let you out of jail. And that makes no sense. So I understand people with the bail reform concept, but we wouldn't have enough jail cells to keep everyone incarcerated.
That's that thing we were talking about earlier. You can't police your way out.
No.
You do need to address it at the root cause, right?
And 100%.
Have we, I mean, like you say, because we've talked about this for years and years and years and years and years. Have we done that? I mean, have we, that's what the bail rules that were brought in were meant to do, right? And now we were in a position where it hasn't worked and we're critical of the quote unquote woke policies and the lack justice system. So where's the line? How do you find the balance?
You know, it's interesting, and it's, I think it's almost too simple, and it's too simple for us to sometimes understand, is the permission that we can give someone, and this is the power that we have in law enforcement, is the permission we can give someone to be different. And what I mean by that is I have several people in my life that I used to put in jail,
yeah,
but they're in my life now differently.
Yeah.
And I'll use the example. I call her my adopted daughter. She calls me dad. I put her in jail for conspiracy to commit murder when she was 18 years old, and she went to jail for 5 years where she gave birth to her first daughter in remand center. I started, because I was listening to her on Wiretap, I heard these two different people. I heard this gangster, and I heard this really nice sister who was trying to take care of her brothers because their parents died.
Yeah.
And just going in, spending time with her, and having conversations with her, and giving her opportunities, she now is doing wonderfully. She's never committed another offense. She's married to a great person. She's a great mom. And it was nothing more than just spending some time and giving someone some permission to be different than what they've been told they are. That concept of labeling theory, which is an old theory, but it seems to be true. People will strive to the label that they're given.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we don't realize in policing that we have the ability, instead of being like, oh, you're a piece of crap or whatever, it's the, you know what, I think you can do a lot better for your life, and if you need anything, let me know. And it's simple things like that, and I've been fortunate, and you know, it's been something that's been wonderful for me, is I've got to see people succeed.
Yep.
Just
yep.
by saying those words. And I think we need to bring the concept of compassion into the justice system as a competency, where we are compassionate with the people we arrest. And there's evidence that shows if you arrest a domestic violence offender with compassion, they're less likely to recidivate. They're less likely to reoffend. Just how we
deal. Okay, what do you mean arrest with compassion? What's that look?
You know, it's having, when you arrest somebody, you can arrest somebody professionally and just the facts kind of thing.
Yep.
But you can also be like, hey, I know you're going through something.
Yep.
I'm not a therapist. If there's anything you need, and one of the things that happened to me lots, and it's happened to many police officers, is, can you please not put the handcuffs on me in front of my kids?
In front of the kids, yeah.
And some police officers will say, nope, that's policy, I have to do that. And some will say, of course, man. Like, So it's knowing those weaves and those bobs and being, it sounds silly, it's just being nice. Because when you're in those situations, and I've been in those situations, and don't get me wrong, I have been the wrong way too.
Yep,
I have made mistakes. I have been the guy who loses it and has a bad temper because someone's called me names and whatever, and I'm calling them names back. So I'm not in any way saying I'm some perfect specimen.
Sure.
What I'm saying is, what I learned through my career is, when you are compassionate, you sure see a change in people. And like after the murder of George Floyd, I had multiple people call me I've arrested and ask me if I was okay. That to me was like a huge compliment. Like, you can be compassionate and we can be on the opposite sides of the fence, but we can actually be nice to each other. And I think that's important.
Part of me is sitting here thinking, yeah, but that's impossible. It's not, because you've done it, but it seems to be, if I'm a cop who's out there trying to just get through the day, that seems like a lot to ask, but maybe it's not.
Well, and you know what, when you look at those things and you look at the research on police legitimacy, Tom Tyler does so much of it. If the community sees you as legitimate, so if you go into that community and you are, and I learned this in beats, like I was walking a beat and I was coaching boxing, I was coaching kids who I was arresting.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was in the corner with kids that were gang members, and the gang members were cheering the kid on, and then I was on the fight card later as the main event, and the gang members were cheering me on. And it was something I learned throughout the system, is we actually aren't that different.
Right, yeah, and we're all people here.
And that was the beauty of community policing, and for me, was you get to be part of that community. And even though you're on the different sides of the fence, you can do that with care and compassion and be nice to each other. And it sounds so simple, but the research shows that if you are seen as a legitimate power holder by the community, that you have to use force less, people commit crime less, people reoffend less. And it's really that being nice is your number one crime prevention tool. And and that's just not me talking randomly. Like,
yeah,
there's a ton of research on that. Tom Tyler, Justice Tank, could be Anthony Bottoms. You can look it up if anyone wants to email you. I'll email them papers. Because that's really a huge component of it. And then you start to be seen as, and I had people call me and apologize to me for offending.
Is that right, eh?
Like, call me up and say, I'm sorry, man, I didn't mean to let you down. I did this, and I'm sorry I did. And yeah, I'm like, well, you don't have to apologize to me, but don't do it again.
Yeah.
But it's that weird thing, and that's what the beauty of community-based policing, when you get right down to it and you become part of the fabric of that community, you just become part of the fabric of that community.
Yeah. Dan, we're out of time. I could talk for hours. We'll have to do this again in the near. Maybe we'll make this a regular thing.
Absolutely.
We'll have a chat. Dan Jones, who is the chair of justice studies at Northwest College, longtime police officer with the Edmonton Police Service. Dan, thanks for being here. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Thanks for having me.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.